Writing his novel Dr. Zhivago and knowing that it won't be published in Russia without censorship, Boris Pasternak has given the manuscript to an Italian publisher. The Soviet authorities are furious, condemning it as anti-Soviet. The reader is Nigel Anthony.
The atmosphere in Moscow was becoming more hostile for writers and other artists. And by August 1956, Pasternak was under close watch. Letters to his sister Lydia in England were intercepted by the KGB and never reached her. That month, he was summoned to a meeting with the writers' union leadership. He gave his lover and agent, Ivinskaya, a note to represent him at the meeting. The meeting was chaired by poet and budding functionary, Alexei Sukhov. Privately beforehand, Sukhov asked Ivinskaya politely how Dr. Zhivago had ended up abroad. Ivinskaya said that Pasternak genuinely thought with the spontaneity of a child, and he believed that in the case of art, borders were irrelevant. "Yes, yes," said Sukhov. "It was quite in character, but it was so untimely. You should have prevented him." When the open session began, Sukhov became more and more worked up about Pasternak's treachery. He accused him of being driven by greed. Dmitry Polikarpov, head of the Culture Committee, later told Pasternak that he had to send a telegram to Feltrinelli demanding the return of the manuscript. He was warned that failure to act could lead to very unpleasant consequences. The two men drew up a telegram for Pasternak to send to Feltrinelli. "I have started rewriting the manuscript of my novel, Dr. Zhivago, and I am now convinced that it is not possible to publish the book in its current form. Please be so kind as to return to my Moscow address the manuscript of my novel, Dr. Zhivago, which is indispensable for my work." Pasternak refused to send it. What would Feltrinelli think if he received a telegram that contradicted everything I have written to him up to now? Would he take me for a crazy man or a coward? Numerous other Western publishers already had the manuscript and would go ahead on their own, even if Feltrinelli were to follow the instructions in an obviously extorted telegram. The telegram, in Russian, was sent on August the 21st, 1957. Pasternak, meanwhile, was attempting to get messages to Feltrinelli and others, lest the telegram be taken seriously. When the Italian scholar Vittorio Strada came to see him, he whispered to him as he left, "Vittorio, tell Feltrinelli that I want my book to come out at all costs. It does not matter what might happen to me. The book is my last word to the civilized world." Despite all the intrigue and intimidation, Pasternak appeared remarkably unruffled to his visitors. By September, officials in Moscow were becoming desperate to retrieve the manuscript. Soviet trade representatives in Paris and London attempted, without success, to get the publishers Gallimard and Harville Press to return the manuscript. Feltrinelli replied to Pasternak's telegram on October the 10th. The letter, although addressed to Pasternak, was clearly written for Soviet officialdom and was designed to protect him by shifting blame away from the author and onto the publisher. Feltrinelli reminded his readers that, since the book had still not yet been published in Russia, there was nothing now standing in the way of publication. The first edition of Dr. Zhivago, in Italian, was printed on November the 15th, 1957. It was an immediate bestseller. One of the first reviews appeared in the Corriere della Sera. "You look for a political libel and find a work of art. The old writer wants to know whether we found proof of his artistic beliefs. The answer is, we did." The novel had begun a long journey, but to get back home to Russia, Zhivago would have a secret ally. The Russian-language manuscript of Dr. Zhivago arrived at CIA headquarters in Washington, D.C. in early January 1958 in the form of two rolls of film, provided by British intelligence. Inside the agency, the novel was the source of some excitement. In a memo, Dr. Zhivago was described as the most heretical literary work by a Soviet author since Stalin's death. John Morey, the Soviet Russia division chief of the CIA, wrote, "Pasternak's humanistic message, that every person deserves respect as a human being, irrespective of the extent of his political loyalty, poses a fundamental challenge to the Soviet ethic of sacrifice of the individual to the communist system." The American and British intelligence services agreed that Dr. Zhivago should be published in Russian, but the British asked that it not be done in the US. They feared that overt American involvement could be used by the authorities in Moscow to persecute Pasternak. In the 1950s, the CIA was engaged in relentless global political warfare with the Kremlin. And, as it happened, the CIA loved literature, novels, short stories, poems. Joyce, Hemingway, Eliot, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Nabokov. Books were weapons. If a piece of literature was unavailable or banned in the USSR or Eastern Europe, and the work might challenge or contrast with Soviet reality, the agency wanted it in the hands of citizens in the Eastern Bloc. The CIA believed the power of ideas in news, art, music, and literature could slowly corrode the authority of the Soviet state. To this end, using a host of front organizations and phony foundations, they spent untold millions to fund concert tours, art exhibitions, highbrow magazines, academic research, student activism, news organizations, and book publishing. To funnel its money to the causes it wanted to bankroll, the CIA created a series of private, high-minded organizations. Prominent Americans were recruited to serve on their boards and create the illusion that these entities were stocked with the kind of wealthy benefactors whose involvement would explain away streams of cash. Among the first was the National Committee for a Free Europe. Members included Dwight D. Eisenhower, soon to be president, film moguls Cecil B. DeMille and Darrell Zanuck, Henry Ford II, the president of Ford Motor Company, and Alan Dulles, the new organization's executive secretary. The bulk of the cash came via a weekly check that the CIA routed through a Wall Street bank. The Free Europe Committee's principal project was Radio Free Europe, which began broadcasting in Czech, Slovak and Romanian in 1950, followed soon after by programming in Polish, Hungarian and Bulgarian. It was joined in 1953 by a second station directed at the Soviet Union, Radio Liberation. About one-third of the urban adult population in the Soviet Union listened to Western broadcasts. Alexander Solzhenitsyn called it the mighty non-military force which resides in the airwaves and whose kindling power in the midst of communist darkness cannot even be grasped by the Western imagination. By 1958, the Soviet Union was spending more on jamming Western signals than it spent on its own domestic and international broadcasting combined. The Free Europe Committee also established its own publishing unit, the Free Europe Press. On August 27, 1951, near the Czechoslovakian border in Bavaria, the FEC released balloons that were carried by the prevailing winds across the frontier. They were designed to burst at 30,000 feet, scattering thousands of propaganda leaflets on the land below. A new wind is blowing. New hope is stirring. Friends of freedom in other lands have found a new way to reach you, read one of those first leaflets. Freedom will rise again. Over the next 5 years, the FEC launched 600,000 balloons, dropping tens of millions of pieces of propaganda across Eastern Europe, including a letter-sized magazine. The Czechoslovakian government falsely alleged that a balloon brought down an aeroplane. One balloon did cause a household fire in Austria when a housewife overturned a cooking burner after she was startled by a balloon landing on her home. The new project for the Free Europe Press was to send books across the Iron Curtain. The first mailings, mostly political articles, some translated, some not, were sent from New York and cities across Europe. Many packages never made it to their intended targets or were turned in to the authorities. Through trial and error, the book program's developers learned that if they had books shipped directly from a publisher, they often got through. Even provocative titles, such as Albert Camus' The Rebel. Some delighted responses found their way back to New York. "We are swallowing them passionately. They are being passed from hand to hand," wrote a student from Poland. In 1956, the CIA funded the creation of the Bedford Publishing Company. Its plan was to translate Western literary works and publish them in Russian. Among the works translated were James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, Vladimir Nabokov's Panine, and George Orwell's Animal Farm. Bedford Publishing concentrated on handing out books to Soviet visitors to the West or placing books with Westerners travelling to the Soviet Union. The company also stocked the US Embassy in Moscow with titles. Members of the Moscow Philharmonic were passed books while on tour in the West and hid them in their sheet music for the trip home. Books were also spirited home in food tins and Tampax boxes. In its first 15 years, Bedford distributed over 1 million books to Soviet readers. One KGB chief grumbled that Western books and other printed material are the main wellspring of hostile sentiments among Soviet students. On March the 6th, 1958, George Katkov, the Oxford professor overseeing the English translation of Dr. Zhivago, visited the American consulate in Munich and told them that although Pasternak was eager to see a Russian edition published abroad, he didn't want it done in the United States or by US-funded groups. He fears serious personal difficulties if a Russian edition is first published in the United States. Katkov noted that the academic branch of Mouton & Co., a distinguished publishing and printing house in the Netherlands, was already negotiating for the rights to a Russian edition. The agency decided to use a New York publisher to prepare proofs, but take them to Europe for printing, so no American paper stock, which would be quickly identified as such in Moscow, would be used. The CIA selected the 1958 Brussels World Fair as its target for distributing Dr. Zhivago. This event was already shaping up as a Cold War political battleground. 42 nations, and for the first time, the Vatican, were participating at the 500-acre site. What was especially interesting to the CIA was that the fair offered one of those rare occasions when large numbers of Soviet citizens travelled to an event in the West. Belgium issued 16,000 visas to Soviet visitors. In the first week of September, the first Russian-language edition of Dr. Zhivago rolled off the printing press, bound in Mouton's signature blue linen cover. 200 copies were sent to headquarters in Washington. Most of the remaining books were sent to CIA stations or assets in Western Europe. The largest package, 365 books, was sent to Brussels.
Episode 3 of The Zhivago Affair by Peter Finn and Petra Cuvée was read by Nigel Anthony, abridged by Libby Spurrier and produced by Joanna Green. It's a peer production for BBC Radio 4. After the news, Woman's Hour explores the plight faced by Syrian women refugees displaced by the country's civil war. Before that, news of a new programme starting next Monday.
Take a look at the line where the earth meets the sky. Imagine it on music manuscript paper. The hills suggest a melody, those pylons beat a rhythm. For Radio 4, I'm following six leading musicians as they look at skylines in London, Wales and Scotland and turn what they see into new pieces of music. So join me, Tim Marlowe, the jazzman Courtney Pine and the contemporary composer Anna Meredith on the Millennium Bridge, turning the roofs, cranes and bridges of London into new music in Playing the Skyline. Starting next Monday morning at 9 and again in the evening at 9:30 on BBC Radio 4.